Good afternoon. I am Hank Jones, and you are listening to Hank Jones Poly Sports here at Global Patriot Radio on blogtalkradio.com. It is Wednesday, September the 14th, 2022. And I'm still here. Yes, I'm still here. Global Patriot Radio is still here. Every day, as a matter of fact, 7 days a week. So to interact with the show, of course, you can call in 319-527-6706, or you can come into the chat room. You can come in and listen without going into the chat room. Just find us on blogtalkradio.com, or you can actually get into the chat room and interact like Indy Hawk is doing right now. Or off show, you can contact me via Facebook. Just look up Hank Jones Poly Sports, or you can look for me on Twitter at HPolySports, or email me hjpsports1980@gmail.com, and yeah, I answer those. I actually do. As I said, you can listen as Indy Hawk's doing, or you can call in as Hawkeye Mike and Sue from New Mexico have done. And you know, it's a good way to do it. Both, all good ways. We're actually got a couple calls. This Twitter friend, I've never actually met him, but a Twitter friend who is also a Hawkeye supporter. I'm going to have him on. He's going to talk about his impressions of Hawkeye football, mainly because the echo chamber that is the crew here, me, Mike, Indy, T. Bodie when he calls in, Brother Tommy on those rather rare occasions lately, and he's turning into an Illinois Hawk or hack anyway. So, but anyway. It's just an echo chamber with us. We've been saying the same thing. I want another opinion, and he's thrown out some stuff. This guy on Twitter, he goes by the handle Cap'n Kirk. That's not, I assume he's not really Kirk Ferentz, but if he is, great. But yeah, I just think it's a little bit different perspective, and he's given some good stuff. So, and then of course, Hawkeye Mike and Indy Hawk are going to be in after that, and we'll talk our usual college football stuff. With our what I fear will become our weekly lament. So there you have it. Every Monday on Global Patriot Radio, the Vito Esposito Show featuring Vito and Big Al, Mama Mia No Sharia. That goes at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Tuesdays, Eric is in with the Cross and Crescent discussion, also 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Remember, you need to download a thing to do that one to partake. Wednesdays, of course, me, Hank Jones at 5:30. And then Thursdays, Paul Sutliff with the Sutliffian Report. Paul's in at 6 o'clock Eastern as well. And then Fridays, Andrew Herod with Conservative Casual Friday. He's in usually around noon, but just always check all of the time, because sometimes we do move them around a little bit. Saturday nights from 10 p.m. to midnight Eastern Time, Minister Usama Dakduk, assisted by the beautiful Christy, revealing the truth about Islam. And then Sundays, Eric's back. Sort of an encore, I guess. It's sort of a true, real interfaith dialogue, but a continuation of Cross and Crescent discussion. So there you have it. You got other shows on Big Blog Talk Radio as well. Annie with Southern Sense Radio. Airwaves America with the Dave and G. Ski Rocks show. Chief with Simple Things in Life. Joseph Gibson, Understanding the Times in Which We Live. Sally over at American Statesman on Mondays, but it's not always consistent. I mean, they were dark for a while, but they're back at least from what I've seen. That's a good show as well. All good shows here. Tim Tapp, of course, would Tap Into the Truth as well. I am here in Electric Hank Land, hanging out. My wife is over in Acoustic Hank Land. She's working for a living. The little Aussie is here. Not sure if she's eaten yet. We had a little thunderage coming over, and she's not keen on that. It's funny, when I go outside and she runs out with me, she doesn't freak out at all. But when she hears it in the house, she doesn't like it. Never really understood that, but she's a tough little dog. But okay, let's get to our obituaries. Of course, we got a biggie this week, but we'll talk more about that later. Last Wednesday, we lost former CNN anchor Bernie Shaw, to pneumonia at age 82. Bernie Shaw, although he was likable, Yeah, he still worked for CNN, but at least he worked for them in a time when they had some credibility and were less overt in their bias. And I would include him in that. I think you never had to guess where he stood, but he wasn't. He didn't wear it on his sleeve. He wasn't, you know. We also lost former Iditarod champion Lance Mackey to throat cancer at age 52. Though he was plagued by some substance abuse problems, he was a four-time winner. He's also the first person to win both the Iditarod and the Yukon Quest in the same year. Yukon Quest is actually considered the tougher of the two races. Thursday, we lost musician and songwriter Sonny West at age 85. He co-wrote two of Buddy Holly's hits, Oh Boy and Rave On, Queen Elizabeth II, Britain's monarch and head of the Commonwealth, at age 96. I'll go into the Queen in detail later on. But yeah, that's you know, so far not the best week for you know, obituaries. Then we got this one. Also last week, last Friday, or no, I'm sorry, it wasn't last Friday. It was this past Monday. We lost jazz keyboard great Ramsey Lewis, who died in his sleep in his Chicago home at age 87. In crowd, you would hear this as bumper music to a lot of sporting events and such. Yeah, he truly was an icon. This hit 1965, hit number 5 on the pop charts, and the album itself made it to number 2. Yeah, a jazz album did that. He formed the Ramsey Lewis Trio with Isaac Holt and L.D. Young, and then they left to form Young Holt Unlimited. They did a song that was rather popular as well called Soulful Strut. He added a drummer after that by the name of Maurice White. Yeah, Earth, Wind, and Fire's Maurice White. We'll have a musical tribute to him, which also, by the way, featured White and Earth, Wind, and Fire. We'll feature that during the break later on. Yesterday we had several losses. First, R&B singer Jesse Powell passed away from cardiac arrest at age 51. We also lost French-Swiss film director Jean-Luc Godard at age 91 after assisted suicide. Probably his most notable film was his first, a 1960 film called Breathless, no, not the Richard Gere one. It featured Jean-Paul Belmondo and Gene Seberg. Then finally, yesterday we lost former special prosecutor Ken Starr at age 76 after complications from surgery. Ken Starr was assigned by then-President Bill Clinton to investigate the Whitewater scam. Remember that? Whitewater? Yeah, Whitewater, way back then. And also, the suicide, suicide of Vince Foster. Now, what he ended up finding was a cigar and a blue dress with stuff on it. While Starr was continually belittled and denigrated by Big Left, mainly James Carville, his investigation did lead to an impeachment of President Clinton and the 5-year suspension of Bill Clinton's law license. And to this day, many doubt the suicide angle of Foster's death. The claim was that Foster suffered from undiagnosed and untreated depression. How they detected that in an autopsy or in any post-death investigation is anyone's guess, of course. Starr was also part of President Trump's legal team during the first sham impeachment. And today, we lost Greek actress Irene Pappas to Alzheimer's at age 93. Her most notable roles were in the film The Guns of Navarone and Z, and of course, Zorba the Greek. She actually won awards at a couple of film festivals for other stuff not relating to those films, but for films that I did not name there. But yeah, so some great losses this week. Hey, before we move on, don't forget my friends at Alliance Communications, Central Florida's 24-hour call center for messaging and call center services, hospital clinics, medical clinics, information gathering services, service companies, government agencies. They can do it all. They'll get the job done. They work with remote staff, so if you're looking to take a remote job, give them a call as well. They can be reached, of course, at 800 855-3738, or find them on the interwebs at alliancecommunications.com. Here's an internet laughy. This one comes from News That Matters. It says, Barron Trump reportedly considering crack cocaine, Russian prostitutes, and corrupt international business dealings in order to convince the FBI to leave him alone. It ain't wrong, is it? It ain't wrong. Here's a quickie. Anyone get a chance to hear Vito and Al's show this past Monday? If you didn't, I would urge you to go in and listen to the archive of it. They had a guest on who spoke about the situation at the border. The guy was fascinating. The interview as a whole was eye-opening, eye-popping, maybe a little frightening. His name's Tom Trento. He's with United West and DefendTheBorder.org. He does some really great work with regard to border security and anti-terrorism issues, as well as Islamic issues, especially as it deals with overt anti-Semitism. Yeah, give it a listen. Vito Esposito show with Big Al from this past Monday, so September 12th. Great, great episode. Let's get to our news, notes, idiocy, crap, interesting stuff. Sad news from Alaska. Former Republican State Representative Vic Coring was killed in a head-on car crash last week. He served 12 years in the Alaska State House, which included chairmanship of their Legislative Special Committee on Oil and Gas. He was accused of several corruption charges in 2006 and resigned in early 2007. A jury convicted him on three counts. He was sentenced to 3.5 years in prison. He appealed the decision. And, of course, the U.S. Department of Justice admitted to withholding information that would have aided his defense. After having the verdict and sentence overturned, he pled guilty to one count of accepting bribes and was given credit for the 1 year he served as part of the original verdict. Vic Coring later set up a website detailing how the Justice Department went after him and framed him, targeting him as a conservative, as well as his part of an oil and gas committee. Those folks aren't really into fossil fuels, are they? No, they aren't. Moving on, the LIV Golf Tour will conclude its first season the last weekend of October at Trump National in Doral, Florida. The purse of $50 million is the largest in the history of the sport. The setup for the tournament is rather interesting. Here's some of it from ESPN.com. So basically, team format. 12 four-man teams will compete for $16 million first place prize. Teams will be seeded 1 through 12. The top four seeds will receive a bye to the quarterfinals. The other eight will compete in qualifying rounds. How will the seeding be determined? By a closest to the pin shootout by the team captains, believe it or not, which will take place immediately after they draft players. That was the format for how the team championship will work in golf and LIV Golf's rules and regulations, which were released by a U.S. district court in California as part of its federal antitrust suit against the PGA Tour. It'll be played over 4 days as a match play, head-to-head knockout playoff, winning team crowned as the team series champion. Each team will be ranked and seeded 1 through 12 based on the shootout, with each team captain having one shot to hit toward a target in a nearest-the-pin style shootout. According to the section in this thing, the team whose captain's shot finishes closest will be designated as the first seed, and each remaining team will be seeded based on the proximity to the target of each other team captain's shot. Still being finalized, very unsurprising they would pick something so tacky and unoriginal to try and expand the game, a longtime PGA Tour player told ESPN. It's effing lame is what it is. It's lame as S. It's XFL. It's and one. Mixtape Tour. It's not competitive golf. It's a circus. Yeah, but winning teams splitting $16 million sport. According to the document, in the qualifying rounds, the fifth-seeded team will have the first choice in picking its opponent, with the second-seeded team following with its pick, and then the third and fourth losing teams will be eliminated after each round. Team matches will consist of two individual match play contests and one pairs match play contest. Each match is worth 1 point. Ties will be broken by a sudden death playoff, with the captains picking two players to compete. Second place team will split $10 million. Third team gets $8 million. Fourth gets $4 million. Fifth through eight will split $2 million. And nine through 12 split $1 million. So, yeah, regardless, if you're in this thing, you're getting 250K, regardless of how you do. A PGA player said, it's not competitive. The real competitive golfers, the guys that play on the PGA Tour and compete in majors, it's why they're just not interested in this nonsense. Really? Yeah, sure. LIV CEO and Commissioner Greg Norman will grant as many as 12 exemptions to players to compete in the team championship. The next 24 will be determined by the leading players in the individual rankings who competed in at least four regular season tournaments, and the remaining 12 will go to the highest ranked players in the official World Golf ranking, provided they have participated in at least three of golf events. Maybe, but interesting. I mean, you know, XFL, CFL, they all have their ways of attracting viewers and fans. I mean, who doesn't watch CFL football for some of its stuff? Who doesn't watch arena football with some interest in the way the game is played? Of course you do. About the only thing that makes college baseball less boring than Major League Baseball is the fact they use aluminum bats. I mean, other than that, it's pretty much the same thing. When it's being televised, the first inning of any baseball game is long as hell for whatever reason. And in that vein, Irishman Rory McIlroy says, again, he wants no LIV Tour players representing Europe in next year's Ryder Cup. My thought, the LIV Tour continues to live rent-free in Rory McIlroy's head. And his obsession with being anti-anything LIV is starting to resemble the type of behavior we normally see from those affected by Trump derangement syndrome. Keep it up, Rory. I'm sure they're going to give you the final say. And if not, always boycotting is your nuclear option. What the hell, why not, huh? Yeah, I just think Rory McIlroy is a little over the top with his anti-LIV Tour stance. Okay, now on to Queen Elizabeth II. I'll tell you what a lady she was. Born Elizabeth Alexandra Mary of the House of Windsor in 1926. Coincidentally, that's the year my father was born. She served as an auto mechanic in World War II. Her father, King George VI, ascended to the throne in 1936, when his brother, King Edward VII, or the 8th, I remember, I think it was the 7th, abdicated in order to marry American divorcee Wallace Simpson. Queen Elizabeth married Philip Mountbatten, who later became Prince Philip of Edinburgh, in 1947. They had four children, Charles, a.k.a. now King Charles III, Anne, who became an equestrian for a time and rode for UK at the 1976 Olympics in Montreal, Andrew, who probably is most famous for his womanizing, including speculation about his involvement in the whole Jeffrey Epstein, Ghislaine Maxwell mess. And then Edward, now the Duke of Edinburgh, only married once and pretty much just your average boring peripheral royal family member. I mean, the guy is 13th in line for the throne. We literally got a better shot of seeing Donald Trump back in the White House. It's not even close. Anyway, Queen Elizabeth ascended to the throne as Queen Elizabeth II in 1952 after the death of her father. She reigned for over 70 years, longest in British history, longest of any female head of state, and second longest in all of history behind only King Louis XIV of France. And although the country didn't react well to her handling of certain issues, most notably the death of Charles's first wife, Princess Diana, British support for the monarchy actually remained high, and their love for her has really never been in doubt. She was involved in World War II relief efforts as early as the age of 14, and she and her sister, Princess Margaret, actually walked incognito among the crowds in celebration of VE Day. She reasoned to her parents that she needed to see and celebrate with the rest of her country, not in behind closed doors. She was actually the target of attempted assassinations at least twice, and thought, and though the 1980s and 90s were not kind to her in terms of sentiment against like her wealth, the old class envy, she handled herself with dignity and class and some skill, actually some skill. During her first assassination attempt, during which she was riding her horse in a public area, she maintained control even after the horse became spooked by the shots. Her dignity, humility, and class was what got her past much of any animosity, and is what ultimately led to her being so endeared and revered. The reaction to her death from her country's citizens, I think, is proof of that. Now to Big Lef's reaction, believe it or not, when it was initially announced that she was in ill health and that family members were traveling to be with her, several lefty progressive types ran their mouths and their tweets. I won't dignify any of them by repeating their names or what they said or wrote. Suffice it to say, though, when it was officially announced that Queen Elizabeth II had passed away, several of those tweets and postings disappeared. But we know who they are, what scumbags they are, and that they will always suck, no matter what, at being human. Be that as it may, long live the Queen and God save the King. Rest in peace, dear, classy, noble lady. You truly were a queen. Truly were a queen. So, another week of paddling, delayed SpaceX Falcon 9 launch, and the Artemis 1 still sits on the launch pad out at Cape Canaveral. I get to see it five or six nights a week. It's still majestic and beautiful, but it just sits there. And I'm kind of bummed. But I did get some info from one of my paddle guests, who happens to be a contractor out at the Cape. No, not Cape Cod. The Cape. Cape Canaveral. Here goes. The next launch window is September 19th to October 3rd. If there is no launch, the Artemis 1 will be returned to the vehicle assembly building, where vehicles are assembled and prepared for each space mission, each space flight. The reason is pretty mundane, yet also pretty important. Some of the abort mechanisms aboard Artemis 1 are charged ongoing by batteries. However, those batteries can only charge for so long before the system needs a hard charge. Personally, I probably have enough extension cords out in my shed to make it work. They haven't asked. Still, for now, while there is still bioluminescence in the Indian River Lagoon, I get to see Artemis on the pad as well as view whatever launches take place, except for last night's, which was scrubbed for tonight, and since this is my show day, I won't be paddling. I'll have to watch it the old-fashioned way from my yard or my roof. When Artemis 1 finally does go, consider this. It will be anywhere from 8.5 to 8.8 million pounds of thrust. Now, the Saturn 1B and Saturn 5 from the Apollo days were from 7.1 to 7.5 million pounds of thrust. So we're talking almost 25% more. We're also talking about a much longer mission. The Apollo missions were anywhere from 5 to 12 days. This first mission, though unmanned, will last 42 days. And rather than just heading to the moon, Artemis 1 will go out and past and around the moon before returning to Earth. It's going to be big, folks, as in huge. Huge. I can't wait. I know most of you are probably thinking, what the hell, Hank? Who cares about the Artemis 1 launch? I do. It's going to be really, really cool. Why? Because it is. Consider this. When space tragedy has hit our space program, economically, it reverberates. It reverberates through Florida, Central Florida and Florida. It reverberates into places like Alabama and Texas and California and Ohio and Washington State. Yeah, it's has a huge effect. Nevada and Arizona, where there's also stuff that goes on for the space program on occasion. Virginia, where they have one of the landing sites for the rocket boosters that now return after being jettisoned. Interesting note. Okay. Unlike when you see the launches now and you see them jettison the rocket boosters, with the Artemis, about an hour and a half into flight, there is what's called the translunar injection. This is the rocket booster that fires it, gives it the escape velocity, if you will, to get out into beyond just Earth orbit and into a lunar trajectory. Believe it or not, that stuff, that just falls. That's not being recovered. The person I spoke to said, yeah, it's not something we'd really want to recover because it's going to be blown to smithereens. I mean, that's what it's going to take. But yeah, so unlike now when we see, even with the shuttle, how we used to see, when you see, you know, anywhere from a minute to 2 or 3 minutes in when we would see stuff jettisoned, that doesn't happen in this case. Now, there might be some stuff that comes off and is returned, but the translunar injection, no, that doesn't happen for like an hour and a half, roughly. And it's going to be really cool. It's going to be momentous. I mean, it's what will get us back to the moon. And if we go beyond in our lifetime, this is setting the stage for that to happen. Stage, get it? Like stages of the launch and of the spacecraft. So last week at the remembrance of the 50th anniversary of the Munich Massacre at the 1972 Olympic Games, a very humbling and very decent thing happened, as done by Germany's president, Frank-Walter Steinmeier. Here's the story from ESPN, and it's better for me to read a little bit because otherwise I'm going to get too personal and I'm going to throw all my personal animus into it. So it says, Germany's president apologized for multiple failures by his country before, during, and after the 1972 Munich Olympics, as he joined his Israeli counterpart and relatives of the 11 Israeli athletes killed in the attack by Palestinian militants at the Games 50 years ago. The anniversary ceremony at the Fürstenfeldbruck airfield outside Munich, which was the scene of the botched rescue attempt that left 9 of the athletes dead, a West German police officer, and 5, of course, of the terrorists, came days after an agreement that ended a long dispute over compensation. German President Frank-Walter Steinmeier and Israeli President Yitzhak Herzog laid wreaths at the site. Now, last week's agreement headed off a threatened boycott of the anniversary event by relatives of the slain athletes. They will receive a total of 28 million euros or dollars in compensation, a significant increase from the initial 10 million euro offer. As part of the agreement, Germany agreed to acknowledge failures by authorities at the time and to allow German and Israeli historians to review the events surrounding the attack. "We are talking about a great tragedy and a triple failure," Steinmeier said. "The first regards the preparation of the games and the security concept. The second, the events of September 5th and 6th, 1972. The third failure begins the day after the attack, the silence, the denial, the forgetting." Let me interject here. Yeah, Israel had several times complained about the lack of security at the games. It's they were placed in an area that was theoretically off the beaten path, but it also left them isolated as well. East German athletes and agents, those terrorists in weeks before to scout the area. Back to the story. Before dawn on September 5th, 1972, eight members of a Palestinian group called Black September clambered over the unguarded fence of the Olympic Village. They burst into the building where the Israeli team was staying, killing wrestling coach Moshe Weinberg and weightlifter Yossi Romano. I referenced Joseph Romano last week, of course. The Olympic Village security, remember, they didn't want to have armed guards or anything, so they had these people walking around in these disgustingly gross robin's egg blue uniforms. Back to the story. Some Israeli athletes managed to escape, but nine were seized. The captors demanded the release of more than 200 Palestinians held by Israel and two German left-wing extremists, Bader-Meinhof, of the Bader-Meinhof gang, that were held in West German prisons. The attackers demanded a plane and safe passage to Cairo. After a day of tense negotiations, the assailants and their hostages were allowed to leave aboard two helicopters for Fürstenfeldbruck. Sharpshooters at the airfield opened fire. They weren't sharpshooters. The attacker threw a grenade into one of the helicopters carrying hostages, which exploded, and shot the hostages in the other helicopter. The Olympics were put on hold for 34 hours, but then resumed, with then IOC chief Avery Brundage insisting that, quote, the games must go on. Steinmeier acknowledged that the politicians of the day also, quote, did everything to return to business as usual as quickly as possible, unquote. We cannot make up for what happened or for what you experienced and suffered in the way of resistance, ignorance, and injustice, Steinmeier told the victims' relatives. That shames me. As this country's head of state and in the name of the Federal Republic of Germany, I seek your forgiveness for the inadequate protection of the Israeli athletes at the Olympic Games in Munich and for the inadequate resolution afterward. For the fact that what happened could happen, he said. The compensation settlement includes payments already made. Immediately after the attack, Germany made payments to relatives of the victims amounting to about 4.19 million marks, about 2 million euros or dollars, according to the country's interior ministry. In 2002, the surviving relatives received an additional 3 million euros, Germany's DPA news agency reported. Steinmeier noted that the Palestinian militants and their Libyan helpers were directly responsible for the murders and said it is, quote, very bitter that no word of sympathy, no word of regret comes from political representatives of those countries today, unquote. During a recent visit to Berlin, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas caused outrage by refusing to condemn the 1972 attack and saying that he could point to, quote, 50 Holocausts by Israel. This is amazing. It's amazing that it took 50 years to happen. It's amazing that the president of the host country was so open in his admitting of the host country's failures. And it's amazing that it took a possible lawsuit by survivors of the victims to make it happen. First, why are the survivors still having to fight this 50 years later? Why are the widows and children and grandchildren not getting what is due them? My God, some of these children never got to know their fathers. And it's taken this long for any form of justice, economic or otherwise. And it's taken 50 years for Germany to formally apologize. Second, why does Frank-Walter Steinmeier even expect that vociferously anti-Semitic Palestinian or Libyan terrorists would feel remorse or almost laughingly condemn the attack? These people are bigots and racists of the highest degree. They have not, will not, and never will look at the Munich massacre as anything but an act of bravery and heroism from the mindless robots that were programmed to carry out the attack. Now, why Germany would allow a psychopath like Mahmoud Abbas to visit Berlin is equally mind-boggling. That he was somehow coaxed into addressing the Munich massacre is even more mind-boggling. It should be noted, exactly one Arab nation leader spoke out against the attack at the time. King Hussein of Jordan actually called it, quote, a savage crime against civilization perpetrated by sick minds, end quote. The terrorists that were killed were returned to Libya with full pageantry, with funerals bearing full military honors. When the captured terrorists were later returned, remember after the fake hijacking of a Lufthansa flight, they received a hero's welcome and a press conference. Finally, why haven't other countries been more active in condemning the event? Why has there been very little remembrance and memorializing, and why in hell do we not all collectively hang our heads in shame? Then International Olympic Committee President Avery Brundage not only failed to acknowledge the massacre, he had to have both arms twisted and wrenched in order to postpone the 1972 Games until after the conclusion of that terrible massacre. And at the memorial service the next day, he all but ignored the attack in his comments. The fact one of the representatives of one of the Israeli victims died of a heart attack at the memorial service has almost vanished from any news accounts, with little to no acknowledgement of the toll tragedy took not only on the victims and the Israeli teammates and coaches, but also the families and the friends and the country as a whole. As Golda Meir said at the time when they talked about giving in to the demands, she said, we do this, every Israeli, every Jew worldwide is a sitting duck, is a moving target. I'll say this, though, at least the German president, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, he had the dignity and the humility to step out and acknowledge it all in public. So maybe that's a bit of progress being made. Here's an awesome piece from Sean Fleetwood, writing for The Federalist. It actually appeared on the Conservative Review site. It discusses why Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, John Roberts, has only himself to blame when he complains about the recent anger and skepticism leveled at the court by both Big Left and Big Fringe with regard to credibility. This is really good. Sean Fleetwood's got his act together. Titled, For Lack of Public Confidence in the Supreme Court, John Roberts Has Only Himself to Blame, appeared today. Subtitle is, Roberts has given the country every reason to be skeptical of the court's ability to operate freely from the politics that plague America's societal discourse. U.S. Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts is back in the public spotlight, and his latest remarks on judicial integrity are turning heads. Appearing at the 10th Circuit Bench and Bar Conference in Colorado Springs, Colorado on Friday, the Chief Justice spoke out about the perceived credibility of the Supreme Court among the American public and how disagreeing with its opinions, quote, is not a basis for questioning its legitimacy, unquote. And he says, the court has always decided controversial cases and decisions have always been subject to intense criticism, and that is entirely appropriate, Roberts said. But I don't understand the connection between the opinions people disagree with and the legitimacy of the Supreme Court. Following the Supreme Court's rulings on several hot-button issues this past session, such as the striking down of Roe v. Wade and upholding of Second Amendment rights, Democrats and their sycophants and legacy media have been quick to vilify the High Court and call into question its ability to operate as an independent body simply because a majority of justices didn't give them the outcomes they wanted. While it's fair for Roberts to push back against such logic and distinguish the legitimacy of the High Court from its judicial decisions, his next comments were impossible to take seriously. And they are thus. If the court doesn't retain its legitimate function of interpreting the Constitution, I'm not sure who would take up that mantle, the Chief Justice said. You don't want the political branches telling you what the law is, and you don't want public opinion to be the guide about what the appropriate decision is. Fleetwood then goes on, for someone who holds the rank of Chief Justice, the lack of awareness from Roberts is stunning. Throughout his tenure on the Supreme Court, Roberts' judicial decision-making on various high-profile cases has been guided by, quote, public opinion, unquote. When the court was considering the constitutionality of Obamacare in the 2012 NFIB versus Sebelius case, for instance, Roberts reportedly took extensive actions behind the scenes to alter the Supreme Court's final decision on the matter, even though Obamacare is obviously unconstitutional. After initially siding with his Republican-appointed colleagues and striking down the individual mandate of the Affordable Care Act, quote, on the grounds that it went beyond Congress's power to regulate interstate commerce, unquote, Roberts got cold feet over fears of potential public blowback over the high court's impending decision and worked with his Democrat-appointed colleagues to change it. As reported by SCOTUS biographer Joan Biskupic in her book, The Chief, Roberts' bid to play politics led him to form a deal with leftist justices Stephen Breyer and Elena Kagan that upheld and struck down certain portions of the ACA. After trying unsuccessfully to find a middle way with Justice Anthony Kennedy, who was unusually firm and even put off by the courtship, Roberts turned to the court's two moderate liberals, Stephen Breyer and Elena Kagan, a review of The Chief published in The Atlantic reads. The threesome negotiated a compromise decision that upheld the ACA's individual mandate under Congress's taxing power while striking down the Medicaid expansion. Biskupic's reporting findings released by CBS's News' Jan Crawford. She in 2012 reported that, quote, Roberts pays attention to media coverage and that, quote, as Chief Justice, he is keenly aware of his leadership role on the court and is sensitive to how the court is perceived by the public. In spite of his efforts to maintain the court's favorability as measured by off-bias poll results, Roberts' games in the NFIB versus Sebelius case did the exact opposite. As detailed in their best-selling book, Justice on Trial, The Kavanaugh Confirmation and the Future of the Supreme Court, Federalist Editor-in-Chief Molly Hemingway and President of the Judicial Crisis Network, Carrie Severino, detailed, Pew Research reported that after the decision, the court remained at its all-time low 52% approval. The accepted narrative, even among those who welcomed the chief decision, was that he changed his legal position not on principle but in response to public pressure. The right lost respect for him, and the decision won him no friends on the left, which still portrays him as unforgivably conservative and a craven political operative. It was a regrettable outcome for anyone concerned about the legitimacy of the court. Roberts' deference to the constantly changing and poll-manipulated opinions of the American public at the expense of upholding the Constitution didn't stop at the Obamacare ruling either. Over the years, Roberts has routinely abandoned originalism for political activism, with the court's 2022 Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization decision striking down Roe's made-up constitutional right to an abortion serving as a more recent example. Despite Justices Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, and Amy Coney Barrett all correctly maintaining that the precedent established in Roe was unconstitutional garbage, Roberts attempted, yet again, to play politician and convince one of his Republican-appointed colleagues to change his or her vote before the opinion was released. Originally reported by the Washington Post and later Biskupic, Roberts directed his lobbying to save Roe toward justices including Brett Kavanaugh, which, quote, continued through the final weeks of the session. Multiple sources told CNN that Roberts' overtures this spring, particular to Kavanaugh, raised fears among conservatives and hope among liberals that the chief could change the outcome in the most closely watched case in decades. Once the draft was published by Politico, conservatives pressed their colleagues to try to hasten the release of the final decision, lest anything suddenly threaten their majority. The report went on to detail how the abrupt May leak of the Supreme Court's majority draft opinion in Dobbs thwarted Roberts' efforts, with Biskupic noting how the Chief Justice can usually work in private, seeking and offering concessions without anyone beyond the court knowing how he or other individual justices have voted or what they may be writing. In the final opinion, Roberts ultimately sided with the leftist justices of the court in upholding Roe, while also voting with his Republican-appointed colleagues to uphold the Mississippi 15-week abortion law as constitutional. Whether he wants to admit it to himself or not, a decline in confidence in the Supreme Court isn't due to any originalist rulings, but to John Roberts' political activism. The role of a judge is, and always has been, to apply the Constitution as it was originally written by the founders. not manipulate the law to satisfy some personal desire for public approval. In abdicating his responsibility as a justice, Roberts has given the country every reason to be skeptical of the court's ability to operate freely from the politics that plague America's societal discourse. If the Chief Justice had any interest in ensuring the future of the Supreme Court's legitimacy, he would quit acting like Mitch McConnell in a robe and start behaving like the judge he was appointed to be. Yeah, exactly. It was brilliant stuff. Absolutely brilliant stuff. We're going to take a quick break, and then I'm going to check for my guest. I believe he is on the line. But in the meantime, I told you we'd get to Ramsey Lewis. This is a shortened version of this song that was done with Earth, Wind, and Fire, but it's still a great version of it. We'll be back in about 3 minutes. Okay, we are back. That was Ramsey Lewis with Sun Goddess. He sang that with Earth, Wind, and Fire. That was Maurice White on drums and Verdon White on bass, and of course Philip Bailey on backing vocals along with the White Brothers. Great song. The full version, the 8-minute version, is much better. But hey, I just wanted to get the song on. So anyway, as I spoke about earlier. I'm a mutual Twitter follower with a fellow Hawkeye fan on Twitter, and he's given some interesting perspectives. You've heard the echo chamber that is myself and Hawkeye Mike and Indy Hawk. He's had some interesting stuff to say. Like me, he doesn't think it's all blamed out of one, you know, single source by the handle Captain Kirk. Now, if this, we'll know by his voice if this is really Kirk Ferentz. I don't think it is, but is this Hawkeye Kirk?
This is Hawkeye Kirk.
How you doing, man? Good to hear your voice for once.
I'm doing great. Yeah, I am a Kirk. I am not the Kirk.
I kind of figured, but you never know. I mean, you know, it would be nice to you know, just to find out. I have actually met Kirk Ferentz, by the way. He's a really nice guy. I've only met him once, but
yep.
Nice guy nonetheless. So what's your Hawkeye history? When did you attend Iowa? Or
I did.
And when were you there?
I attended, graduated in 91, from 86 to 91 on the 5-year plan. And then I'm the proud father of an alumnus who graduated 18 months ago.
All right.
She's now getting her PhD. She was able to do enough research while she was there to get a skip over grad school, go straight into her PhD at the University of Colorado in Denver in, I guess, microbiology. She speaks over my head, so we just try to hang.
Yeah. Yeah, thank God our kids do that. We know when that happens, we're successful. So how do you watch now primarily? Do you watch on TV? Do you have season tickets?
Yeah. Ever since she left Iowa, we don't go to many games in person. She was in the band, so we would go to also watch her march. Go Fridays to watch the beer band and have a good time. But I pretty much sit at home on my sofa and watch frustratingly, like a lot of other fans.
Yeah, exactly. So you've been there for the Wave then?
Yes, I was actually at the very first Wave game against Wyoming.
Cool.
Yeah, that was also her very first game on that field. That was an emotional day for me because knowing that my kid was in a Hawkeye uniform playing what had now become our fight song, and then having the Wave, boy, that was there were some Niagara Falls going on that day.
Oh yeah, have you seen the I guess it's called The Big Moment on Big Ten Network about the Wave?
If I have, it's been a few years ago. I think didn't that come out a couple years ago?
I don't know when it did. I just watched it this week.
Gotcha.
It just talks about, you know, when it started, and they talked to Nate Stanley because he was, you know, the quarterback. That was his first start, and so, you know, it was pretty cool, no doubt. So
very
you're like
cool.
Me, even though you might be in the state, I'm in Florida. So I watch either, you know, at home or I go to a sports bar with other Hawkeyes. So you've seen the two games. You've seen the offense or lack thereof. From just an on-field perspective, what's your thought? What is the primary issue that you see? I mean, I know what a lot of people say, but what do you see?
I did a little research today, and I'm going to put a number out there, and that number is 1.7. And that number represents what Iowa is what their current yards per carry rushing averages adjusted for sacks.
Okay.
So if they're only gaining 1.7 yards rushing, that's not on the quarterback.
Correct.
Now, I know Gavin Williams has been hurt, and he is expected to be back full speed this week, which will help. But you watch these games. Oh, and then the other one is they're averaging 3.9 yards per attempt. And when I watch these games, especially when they go back to the replay and kind of show it from behind the quarterback, the defense just really seems like they know exactly what's coming. They don't have any worries about a deep threat. I mean, my goodness, they dressed one scholarship wideout in their last game. I know Brody Brecht was available, but that's a lot to put on him considering how injured he's been, plus his time he spent away for baseball.
Exactly.
So you've got one scholarship wideout. You've got a walk-on wideout. And Iowa State knew that there was no deep threat at all. And
sure.
So they just gear up, and they're putting 8 or 9 in the box. They say, you know, we're going to dare you to pass. And then they're immediately in the quarterback's face. And so, Spencer could be more accurate. And there are throws that you watch and say, okay, he had enough time to make an accurate throw. And I agree. I'm not sitting here saying Spencer is this elite quarterback. But what I'm also saying is, realistically, hey, there's a whole lot going on that has nothing to do with Spencer Petras.
Yeah. And frankly, you know, when you mentioned that everybody knows what we're going to do, they've known that since Kirk Ferentz has been coach, really. You know, I mean,
we haven't really had the O-line to back it up.
Yeah, and we, you know, you can think of one year.
If you have the offensive line to back that up, go ahead.
Absolutely.
You know, they can tell them to play.
Yeah.
But they don't have that right now.
Yeah, basically 1 year, 2004, where we totally had to go away from our normal setup. But other than that, you know what you're getting with Iowa. And that's
because
it.
Because there were no tailbacks left.
Yeah,
all the
exactly.
The tailbacks had no knees. I mean, they had, what was the kid's name that finally came in and carried the mail a little bit on the back end?
Sam Brownlee.
There you go. Yeah. I mean, heavens. Yeah.
The leading rusher with 248 yards, I think it was.
Yeah.
And like eight of it on one carry against Ohio State that got like a crucial first down. I mean, it was.
Right.
It was great. Well, you know, you can go. It's not all on Spencer Petras. I mean, yes, there are plays, but boy, and some of them, yeah. I really think, what the heck? I mean, in this last game, I thought, you know, you mentioned Alec Wick. You notice he made a catch that was from any and all
catch.
Angles. Yeah, but from any and all angles, it was an easy catch. It wasn't particularly difficult to think that they needed to review it for any reason. And yet there was a catch by Iowa State on their field goal drive that they did the hurry up. They didn't review. I mean, there were things like that that got me. But that's, you know, again, I'm not going to play lawyer ball and say that's what loses a game, because it's not.
No.
But,
there were three plays that I saw in particular that bugged me. One was the one you just mentioned where when he hit the ground, that ball was moving, and
yeah,
so that
exactly.
technically should not have been a catch. The personal foul on Cooper for late hit. You know, I've seen both sides of that. I've seen takes where they say, you know, clearly forward progress was stopped, so he didn't need to be out of bounds. But at the same time, I've never seen that called.
Yeah.
And then the third one that really bugged me was there was an angle from the west side of the stadium along the goal line that showed that Potterbaum had the nose of the ball over the goal line before it was ever knocked out. Probably should have been a touchdown. Not that, you know, you sit back and you say you only scored 7 points. You can't gripe too much, you know.
Yeah.
If you got to put it out of reach if that's what you're worried about.
I would add the Iowa State touchdown. I think that was clearly offensive interference, but I also, in defense, didn't see what might have led up to it. I didn't see if Moss was, you know, stuff, but, you know, I still certainly think,
looked like to me was that the receiver grabbed Moss's left wrist and pulled it down while the ball was in the air to get his hands out of position. And that should have been called, but, you know, they didn't see it as that. They just saw it as just hand fighting, which happens on every pass. So
And frankly, it's pretty hard to get an offensive pass interference call anyway. It doesn't happen very often. Okay, now your assessment of the sideline. Okay, looking at the sideline, you made one very astute observation. You said, "I'm not going to boo Spencer Petras. He's not the one putting himself out there. He's not the one, you know, sending himself out." So on the sideline, where do you think the problem is, if there is a problem?
Well, I, first and foremost, for everybody's sake, I think that Brian should coach from the box. I don't think he should be down on the field. I don't think he's seeing things well enough from that level. Assuming he can avoid berating officials as they come off at halftime, he should probably be in the box. What I would say too is, and I think this is where a lot of Iowa fans are, what's the harm in giving Alex Padilla some series? I saw somebody, you know, one of my mutual followers, Tigerhawk_King, made a really good point that Michigan, you know, Jim Harbaugh started one quarterback for the entire first game and a different quarterback for the entire second game, so that he could fully evaluate what you know, what direction he wanted to go.
Yeah.
And you know, if this truly was an open competition, either Alex Padilla just looks like garbage in practice, which there are a lot of people in this in sports that don't practice well. I'd much
yeah.
rather see them play well on the field than practice well. It's like my golf game, right? You and I can go out to the range, and I can hit 30 drives straight as an arrow, 280 yards. Put me with trees on either side, now we got a problem.
Yeah.
And I wish it were reverse. I'd rather shank him on the drive or the range and hit him straight on the tee. So I saw Tyler Kluver made a point this week that, you know, maybe the plan is to, you know, let Spencer go out, play like Spencer does, and that's a natural breaking point at halftime. Because here's another interesting statistic. Iowa has, as we all unfortunately know, the 130th ranked offense in the nation. Now, again, small sample size, only two games, but obviously it's bad.
Yeah.
Nevada has the 95th ranked overall defense. This may be in the history of Division I football, both of the subdivision football, the most awful matchup between an offense and defense ever. Ever.
the movable force versus the easily stoppable object. I mean,
something, I don't know. I'm just going to say that if they can't move the ball here, then I don't have a lot of hope.
So I was at the 1985 game against Michigan, speaking of Jim Harbaugh,
mm-hmm.
where we were, you know, mm-hmm. the number one offense in the country versus the number one defense. And
yep.
although we did get rooked out of a touchdown call in that game, it was still, you know, that game pretty much went according to the way you would have guessed, you know. I mean, it coming down to, you know, at the end, and it, of course it did. I mean, I guess what I don't understand, too, is, you know, people are saying, you know, hey, it's nepotism. He's, you know, that's the benefits of being the head coach. You can hire your son as offensive coordinator. And we've
right.
seen Brian Ferentz call brilliant games before. So let's not, you know,
right.
let's not go out there and say he's an idiot because he's not. But yeah,
right.
I mean, you know, maybe coaching from the box would help. But I really have to wonder. I get that they say, well, things aren't happening. Things, you know, for Spencer and all that. Well, then where does it need to happen? Because I don't see any really drastic changes on the offensive line. I don't see any effort to get other receivers in there or to work things to get the receivers other than Arlen Bruce and Sam Laporta, get the ball to those other
right.
receivers. I mean, you know what? It's not like Spencer's ever shown a lack of throwing into coverage before. So let them throw into coverage
right.
to someone else. I mean, whatever. I don't know.
Right.
It just seems more stubborn, but it could be a matter of, look, we've got to be ultra conservative because we really aren't that good. I don't know. I mean,
we just don't have the horses.
Yeah. So
yeah.
what's
did
the
you
one
happen
thing?
To watch the, go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, did you happen to watch the Nebraska Georgia Southern game?
Thank God. No.
Okay.
I had a lot to say about Frost though.
Yeah, the deal is that Georgia Southern runs kind of like what Northwestern ran when, like, Coulter was there, really a lot of
yeah.
slants over the middle, quick hitters, and then it opens up everything on the back end. So they use that slant game as their running game. They're not that they don't run some, but they're not trying to just load up and pound it on the A-gap like, you know, other teams would. And it's not complex. It's not complex. And that's where I sit back and I say, you know, every quarterback comes in and says, you know, geez, Iowa's offense is way more complex than you realize to learn. Well, why? Why?
Yeah.
We've got teams out there that use placards with a baseball and a picture of Marilyn Monroe and a tennis racket, and somehow that calls a play and it all works.
Exactly. I don't understand that unless it's – unless it's like public, you know, like coach speak or whatever. I mean, to me, it, you know, because we laugh about the playbook. You know, we laugh about, okay,
yep.
Play number one, Gavin Williams, LaShawn Williams, doesn't matter. Pick a running back off tackle,
right?
Off the, you know, yeah. with the quarterback turning and holding the ball out there to demonstrate to everyone that he is handing it off. But you know, by the way, and then play B, which used to be the same play, different hole, sometimes even different side. And then, you know, third down pass, you know, third down failed pass. I mean, that was our offense through all of the late 1960s and early 70s, so to speak. Now it's like sometimes it's like, okay, lose 3 yards on the first down play that the opponent not only guessed on, but executed much better. So on second and 14, let's throw the dumbest pass, or I don't know. I just don't. That's the part I don't get. And maybe it's just going to take a while. Maybe it's going to take getting Keegan Johnson and Reganey back. I don't know. What's one thing? What's one thing that you want to see? In other words, if you see something, whether it's this weekend or in 4 games from now, what's the one thing you want to see that would tell you, hey, you know what? Things really aren't that bad. Maybe they're even semi good. It just took a little longer to come into place. What is it you'd want to see?
You know, I think that it's probably third down conversions so that they can sustain some drives. If they don't score, if they don't start putting 9 and 10 play drives together, as good as our defense is, they are going to be worn to nothing by the seventh game of the season. I mean, they just can't be out there that long. And you know, I believe it was Riley Moss, who on media day or on Tuesday on their interview day was said that the defense was mad that they gave up a score, that they should never give up a score. And it's like, are you serious? I mean, that's a valiant goal, but you know,
it's a Power 5 team you're playing.
You shouldn't hang your head over giving up 10 points. If you give up 10 points, your offense should be able to cover that almost every single time, you know, and they just can't. I mean, geez, think of the, you know, the 99 yard drive followed by an Iowa 3-and-out.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, you want to talk about just sucking the life out of a group of kids on the defensive side that, oh my God, we got to go right back out there. We couldn't even get one down to give us a chance to get some Gatorade in us, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that that's – I also think that's where giving Padilla some drives. I'm not saying that he needs to start. I'm not saying that he needs to stay in. But give him some drives to give a fresh look because, look, we know the line isn't great. Spencer Petras is not going to – he's not the kind of quarterback to be able to roll out away from pressure and find the open man. He just doesn't have that physical ability. And I'm not going to crush him for that because that's just who he is.
Yeah.
And whereas, you know, Padilla does. And maybe that would take some pressure off of the offensive line that as these guys sort of pour through, that they know that that quarterback may not be where they thought he was going to be when they get there. Because right now, they know that Spencer Petras is going to be exactly where he was the last time they saw him because he just can't move. So, you know, I mean, again,
I think Purdue
mad at him because he's right-handed.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Purdue proved against us last year. They played 3 quarterbacks, and it worked.
Yeah.
You know, why couldn't we try? I mean, frankly, I can think of much worse ways to get your line more up to speed, and that is by – playing 3 different quarterbacks, whether it's or 4, whether it's Joey Labus and Carson May or just Joey Labus, whatever, to simply say, you know what, if the line's saying, well, gosh, we've got to adapt, you're damn right you got to adapt. You'd have to adapt if Spencer was gold and went down to injury, or if Alex was your starter and went. I mean, either way, you're going to have to suck it up. I mean, that's so I don't know that, you know, that you can really coddle or whatever. And you know, I guess that's a good point, though. Just third down conversions would be just, you know, a massive achievement at this point.
Yep.
It really would.
I didn't even look up the percentage because I would have been too depressed.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure.
I know it's not good. I mean, it's not good.
Yeah. And I mean, and the thing is, we've gotten first downs, but most of them haven't been third down conversions. You know, it's either been on first or second down that we've gotten it, or if I don't even know if we've had to go for it on fourth down yet this year. I was kind of disappointed at that, you know, that we actually had a chance at tying the game and almost knowing before the ball was even snapped that our kicker wasn't going to make. And again, I'm not knocking our kicker, but it just doesn't seem like we have
horrible
that.
Horrible conditions.
Yeah. It just seems so that there's just not that feeling like you had with Shudak or any of the others, you know.
No, Duncan would have made it. Shudak probably would have made it. You know, even as a pup, even as a freshman or sophomore, they would have made that. So,
yeah.
I mean, hell, Duncan made a kick as a freshman to beat Michigan. You know, if you don't have ice water in your veins, you're not making that kick, right?
Yeah, so. Exactly. And I just think he's just not, he just doesn't have the, it's just kind of a tough way to throw him in there. So, but, and again, that was on that
right.
drive where, you know, they stopped the play to review Alec Wick's catch. And some would say, well, you know, they review everything. Well, not really. They didn't even take a look at the Iowa State one, number one. But number two,
right.
you want to talk about something that can slow down momentum. I mean, yeah, the Michigan State fake injuries were famous for that. But officials can do that. You know, officials can do that by calling for replays on all
yeah.
the time or whatever. You know, I just, you know, it's, again, that's an incidental to the actual results because, frankly, we didn't deserve to win in a lot of ways we did deserve to. I mean, you block two punts,
yep.
you know, you get
yep.
interceptions and you still don't win. So, yeah.
Turnovers at the goal line, I should
yeah.
say.
Yeah, that was just – so you watching at home this weekend then? Or?
I will.
Yeah.
I will, yeah. It's especially, you know, we live just outside of Des Moines. Those night games, we're fortunate enough that if we need a place to crash, my sister's about a mile and a half from Kinnick.
Nice.
So we can always go there and, you know, and that's where we park. So we don't have to worry about paying for parking as long as we're willing to take a little hike. But I hate rolling in at 11 o'clock when they're all, you know, hunkered down for the night and, you know, waking the whole house up. So we'll
yeah.
watch from home tonight. And, you know, I don't know. It's just that right now, like I said, without a kid enrolled there, as much as I love and seeing my friends at 1122 Melrose, it's just easier. Plus I can set
yeah.
up multiple TVs and watch multiple games, you know, it's just kind of
right,
be the
right.
junkie that I am.
Are you a cable or a satellite or a streamer?
Streamer. Yeah. We
yeah.
have YouTube TV as our primary service. We were actually early adopters. We had, we've been streaming for gosh, 7 years now, 8 years. We,
yeah.
we started out with PlayStation View.
Yeah, I loved PlayStation
View. Which was a really great service, yeah, but unfortunately, because of how they named it, everybody thought you needed to have a PlayStation to use it, and
yeah,
you didn't.
But then they suddenly just discontinued it for their and concentrated on the PlayStation itself. I never got that, but I
yep.
thought it was a great – I mean,
nope.
first of all, for the longest time, it was the only live streaming service that had – Hallmark Channel, which won me major points with my wife at the time. You know, so.
I understand.
So that was, I mean, yes, you had to watch Christmas movies in August, but in the meantime, you didn't have that issue of, you know, so yeah, I actually free trialed my way through the whole season by
yeah.
doing trials at my office,
that.
At my house and, you know, yeah, you got to find a new IP
yep.
each time, but yeah, it's doable.
You can do it. You can do
yeah.
it.
So where did you hang out when you were there? Did you have any special hangouts or?
At Iowa?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, obviously back then it was the Field House and the College Street Club were the two big, you know, kind of, I hate to use the word meat market, but that's what they
right.
were.
Sure.
And then Vito's, we go over to Vito's
and see Brett,
you know,
Musburger.
I never yeah
he always,
I never
that's where he always
the,
went when he's a 10
yep I never was into the Deadwood. I know a lot of people that went there. You know, I not really an airliner guy because that was
sure.
kind of more of, I don't know if it still is, but it was more of a frat bar and I wasn't in a house, so.
Yeah.
And then we moved over to apartments on the west side, and
yeah.
then mostly
so
then
that
kind of
changed
went to like Coralville bars. Yeah.
Oh yeah, Coralville bars
yeah.
were fun though. I mean, I was there from
Absolutely.
80 to 85. I was there from 80 to 85. My last semester was Chuck Long's last, you know, hurrah there. So That was good times. Yep. Great times, actually. So, yeah, I used to – we hung out a lot on the what I called the weirdo block, where, like, George's and Hamburg Inn and Tux and Nickelodeon.
Sure.
And do you remember Dave's Foxhead? Was that there when you were – I mean, I know it was for at least 84.
I don't remember. That's, like, over – I mean, I know where you're talking.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It was across from John's Grocery. It was across from John's Grocery.
Sure. Like, that's kind of where the Bluebird Diner is now, right?
I don't know. I haven't been long enough to know. So it's just, you know,
If you go back to Iowa City, you need to go to John's Grocery and you will be awestruck. It is not
really
Dirty John's anymore. They have a huge selection of craft beers, custom liquors. It's all cleaned up. It's beautiful in there. Yeah, it's
disappointing almost.
in a way. You know, I remember as freshman going over there getting a case of Rhinelander long necks, and it was like 19 cents a bottle for Sundays,
yeah.
And then drink that crap, and then just have the most splitting hangover on Monday morning, you know, because it was just so awful. It was so cheap.
I remember when Fairchild's had a special on Buckhorn, 99 cents for a 12-pack. 99 cents a 12-pack. We bought one time and then like drank half of one and then let that thing sit in our refrigerator the rest of the year because that stuff was so nasty. So
it was nasty. My dad used to drink that with my uncles when I was a kid because it was cheap. Same
yeah,
reason.
Exactly.
It was cheap.
Yeah, it's necessity back then, but now so you're right outside of Des Moines, and when's you going to get back for any games this year then, or?
I don't know if I'll get back for any football games. We definitely will go to a couple of basketball games. We always take a couple of those in. Obviously with the schedule front end loaded, this is still boating season for us and camping and all those nice things you can do on late summer, early fall weekends and still get away with in Iowa. And so we tend to leave the weekends free to do that stuff. And then you'll start looking, when are they back again and what's it going to look like? So we'll see. We'll see. I mean, I can always, you know, obviously the good thing is even with a sold out season, especially now, you're going to be able to find tickets.
Yeah. That first loss usually tends to, open things up a bit. So
it calls the herd.
Yes, it does. So Kirk, I got a couple guys that are going to come on here. Do you want to stay on? We're going to talk our usual normal stuff, but if you want to stay on or you can listen, what do you want to do?
I'm going to pop off. I got to take care of my kids.
Okay. Good enough. Hey man, it's great talking to you.
Enjoyed every minute of it. You too.
And we'll
enjoyed it tons and let's do it again soon.
Absolutely. And stay in touch on Twitter, of course. That's Captain Kirk, or Captain Kirk, otherwise known as Hawkeye Kirk, folks. Thanks for being on, and we will talk at you later.
Thanks, man. We'll see you.
Talk to you. Bye. And so now I've brought in, got Indy Hawk on the line. How you doing?
I'm doing well. How you doing, Hank?
Good, sir. And how about Hawkeye Mike? How you doing?
Doing well. Hank, how are you?
Oh, pretty good. Pretty good. You heard Hawkeye Kirk, what he had to say. This was not a good last week. It was not a good last week at all.
No, it wasn't.
You know, I don't even know where to begin. So let's stay off Iowa for just a couple seconds. What was the biggest non Big Ten upset?
Well, you know, it's quite a week last week. In some ways, it was a really good thing for Iowa because there were so many other eggs being laid. The Texas A&M loss, obviously the Nebraska loss. I didn't see all that game, but I did see the last quarter, the Notre Dame loss to Marshall. I mean, there was just some real stinkers, and leaving Iowa aside, and it was quite a week. It was quite a week.
Yeah, it was. How about you, Indy? What'd you think?
Yeah, I agree with Hawkeye Mike. The A&M loss was a shock. They haven't, as I think I talked about last week, they haven't one of the top recruiting classes in history. Now, whether how much of them they're incorporating, I don't know. But that coupled with the Notre Dame loss, you know, I was kind of hoping it would overshadow the Iowa loss, but I don't think it did.
Yeah. And then Alabama just escaped by the hair of their chinny-chin-chin, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, good point.
Definitely. Definitely. I mean, Bama, that was a close, you know,
I don't
came
think
down
they have
to.
Any business being, yeah, I don't think they have any business being number one. You compare them to Georgia or Ohio State. They, at least from what I saw Saturday, they're not as good.
Yeah.
Now, you know, it's one game. And, you know, in some ways, I like the way they do it with the bowl, the one that counts, right? The bowl thing doesn't come in until November because you really don't know how good anyone really is until you get like 6, 7, 8 games under their belt.
Yeah.
So, you know.
I just, so, Andy, in your opinion, what was the biggest Big Ten upset?
Well, probably Nebraska.
Yeah.
I mean, that's still surprising. And it was surprising to me they made the move in the middle of the year, even though, you know, I would have thought they would have made the move before this year started. But that's hard, making a change in the middle of the year. And they had some contract thing with a bonus or something that was passed, I think, to October 1. But anyway, I was a little
bit
surprised.
Yeah, they wouldn't even wait for that.
Yeah, so Mike, would you agree or no? Would you think the Wisconsin upset was bigger?
And I left that out too. What a big upset that was! But I think Nebraska was worse. If you remember what we asked when you asked us, I think on the first week about whether Frost would make it through the year, and I said I thought he would because even if they, I think it was after they lost Northwestern, because I didn't see him losing to North Dakota or Georgia Southern, so I thought that would probably mean if they got rid of him, it would be at the end of the year. But I did say that if he lost one of those two games, all bets were off, and that's exactly what happened.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not
they
even
just
sure.
Wouldn't put up with that.
Yeah, I'm not even sure how they lost, really, but at the same time they did. So, you know, Georgia Southern has a history of being a tough program, so it's not like that's, you know and ours, you know, you can't really even call our
Sun Belt conference or something.
Yeah, yeah. Sun Belt. You can't even call ours necessarily an upset, other than the fact we lost at home and blocked two punts. But you know, be that as it may.
Right.
So, so what do you get? What do you get, Mike? If you had to guess, where do you think Frost ends up? Do you think? I mean, obviously he's done this year, but where do you think he ends up?
Oh man, high school somewhere maybe. I don't know. No, it's too early to say. I mean. He had a lot of success at Central Florida. You might know more about that, Hank, than I do.
Yeah, he did. No, he did.
There.
He did.
He had success.
It
seemed to click there. Yeah, I don't know whether that's an indication that Nebraska's just a lost cause, or he just never seemed to. You know, the thing is when you lose as many one score games as he did, what is it he's like 5-22, and he's lost the last 9 or 10 in a row. The law of averages would go against that. And to me, there's something really wrong. I don't care who your team is when you're losing every single time like that. And so I don't know. Maybe he needs a little time away, then we'll, you know, ask me in a couple of years.
Yeah. Andy, how about you? What do you think? You think he gets back a head coach job, or do you think he goes the assistant route for a couple seasons?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't have a good read. He's pretty cocky, pretty arrogant coming in, and that was a fan base too. Boy, when he came in, it was like, well, here we come. It's all over. I saw an article on it's going to be an interesting game this weekend. Oklahoma comes in, and – you know, you got already hearing the who's the next coach. Mark Stoops, he seems like he shows up on every single coaching search.
I thought Urban Meyer was the front runner.
he's going to be in town. But that's
among the
TV
Nebraska
show.
Fan base, among the Nebraska fan base, it's between Urban Meyer and, who's the other one?
But Matt Campbell is his name.
Well, actually, Matt Campbell was actually mentioned on one of the Big Ten shows. So, you know, Mike, you mentioned, you know, Central Florida. He was beloved here for a while. They kind of assumed, well, he's got it better here than he'd ever have at Nebraska, so he's not leaving. And then he left, and it didn't sit well, you know, declaring them the national champion, but not even staying around for, you know, barely for the return trip home from the Peach Bowl that year. You know, he barely got home before he was gone. He didn't actually leave on the best terms. Not only that, you know, George O'Leary, who actually got him to a BCS bowl, not that, you know, like 2013 season or 2014 season, I don't remember which, or Leary's last season wasn't good. He went, you know, he did an offer and he quit, but did have success at UCF. And Frost kind of threw him under the bus and said, you know, we finally put this program on the map. And, you know, several people said, well, not really, Scotty boy. You know, you're playing with O'Leary's recruits, and O'Leary's been to a couple, you know, good bowls, including a BCS bowl. You know, and so, yeah, he didn't leave on the best of terms. He didn't. I don't know. I think down here, nobody's crying any tears for the guy. Let's put it that way.
You know, they got a lot of talent there. They're top 15, 20 every year recruiting. He's got someone could come in there that knows what they're doing, and it could be a pretty quick fix.
Yeah, who knows with Mickey Joseph? I mean, he's a former Nebraska quarterback as well. You know, Tommy Frazier has been running the campaign to get Frost out of there for a while, and Dominican Sue says he's ready to coach. I think if I were a player, I would be wary because he'll probably step on your fingers and chest slam you if you make a bad play. But, you know, I mean, okay, so let's do it. We have to do it. Let's get to the Hawks. What was the most shocking thing, Indy, for you? What was the most shocking thing about the loss?
Well, I think the elephant in the room is the complete inept of the offense. I mean, it's really – I look at the QBR, the top Power 5 QBR is the lowest QBR. It's 1 to 100. Petras is at 1. Now he's at 3.4. The next lowest in the – Power 5 is 13.8. Like, he's not even close. So what bothers me is they're not throwing long. So his average throw is, I think it's like 6-7 yards this season, and he's not completing those. I mean, he's missing some really easy throws. I mean, they're missing some guys, but just the simple – take the layup, make the easy throw, at least complete it. But he seems more off than he ever has. He's got one TD, 9 interceptions in his last 10 games.
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
I don't know. I think Kirk kind of nailed it, though, that, you know, one, they keep putting him out there. But two, you know, I'm not sure that a quarterback change would solve it right now as things stand. Mike, what surprised you most?
On what Indy Hawk said and a little bit of what Kirk said earlier, but I'm probably a little more condemnatory and pessimistic because I mean the total ineptness of our offense. I've seen a lot of Iowa teams, and we all have. It's hard to go back that far, but even going back to the Bob Cummings years, I don't see anything like this. It's just maybe there is. It's hard to remember back that far, but certainly under Hayden or even under Kirk's teams in the last 22 years, and we've seen some pretty mediocre offenses. There was a great point made by John Miller on his podcast earlier talking about how the problems that we've had with some other quarterbacks. Jake Christensen comes to mind, brother Tommy's favorite quarterback at Iowa. And he points out that the difference, though, a huge difference, that, and I think Miller had a good point on this, was that 2008 team, when they finally did make the switch and go to Stanzi, the difference there, and this is what's kind of making things pessimistic here, is that even with Christensen in, they were averaging well over 300 yards a game, and that was one of the best offensive lines that Kirk ever had that team at that time. And
yeah.
And so when you made the switch over to Stanley, if you remember, after they basically benched Christensen after that loss, what Kirk stayed with him too long in the Pittsburgh game,
right.
Lost by 1 point. And then they finally made the break to go. And that, I think that was the second game of the year. And then they made the break to go to Stanley and pretty much stayed with him and turned things around. And you know, so you have a big difference there. But here, you know, you've got a problem with the offensive line. But, you know, the offensive line might be a work in progress. But the problem is that Petras isn't going to get better. And the thing that was really frustrating to me was, and it happened at least a half a dozen times. And if you guys, you know, if you think I'm exaggerating, I don't think I am. But I think at least seemed like a half a dozen times where he went back to pass. Often it was on a third down, and the wide receiver's open. He wasn't getting pressure, and he overthrew him. And
yeah.
It's just killed. That's a half dozen drives. You just kill right there, three and outs, or just, you know, and it just, you know, without a vertical passing game, I don't care who you are, you're not going to be able to run the ball. And we have no vertical passing game. And that's primarily on Petras. The offensive line deserves some of the credit for our ineptness as well. But you know, he makes those throws. And, I mean, you sustain some drives a little bit, and that can change things around. But he was missing, like Indy Hawk said, he was missing stuff. I don't know how, you know, this is his third year and he's doing this stuff and it looks like he's worse than he was last year. I don't know what's going, but what harm can it do to at least give Padilla a shot? We haven't even given anybody else a shot, and he's going to start Petras again after that performance last week. And it's just very disheartening.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think the idea, and I'm not even sure, as Kirk said, it's not so much that you have to start Padilla. But, I mean, and I wouldn't have cared, you know, win or lose, you know, Petras didn't play that well. I mean, when we were winning, he hadn't been playing that well. But what was it going to hurt at the half or at any point? I mean, why are we not even trying? I mean, I just that's what I don't get. I mean, we're trying elsewhere, I assume. I mean, how much are we juggling the rest of the lineup, though, too? I mean, I don't see a lot of changes happening in the O-line. I don't see all kinds of massive substitutions there. So – you know, that's kind of concerning. Why aren't we trying to get more guys on the, you know, receivers on the field? Why not? I mean, I don't know. I just don't get it. I don't, you know, I'm not sure where to go. I mean, let's put it this way. If it's not, let's say it's not going to be a quarterback change. So what is it going to take? I mean, is it going to take a superhuman line? You know, I mean, is it going to take the reemergence of a Sean Green, which I don't think is going to happen anytime soon. I mean, I don't know. I mean, Indy, if you are giving, if Kirk Ferentz calls you up tomorrow, what do you tell him?
I'd say, you know, play some of the young guys. You don't have to go too far from your, but he's very much risk averse, but this is a good young offensive line. We have, I think we've had a top inside of the top 30 recruiting class, first time I think in Iowa history, 2 years in a row.
Yeah.
So there's good young talent. You know, we've started slow before. The line should be good. Get some guys back, yeah. But I don't know why that. I don't know why you have to be here 3-4 years before you can learn our offense or even other areas too.
Yeah.
That's the one. You know, I went and looked at, like, Georgia. Okay, let's look at Georgia's defense. I counted 4 or 5 first, second-year players on that team starting. Or, you know, in the, yeah, starting. So that's better talent. That's a better team. So you can go down to levels below Iowa. It's more of a methodology. We are going to be risk-averse. You're going to be in the program 3 years before we start playing. If you're a quarterback – evidently, you got to study the playbook for 2 or 3 years. I don't know, but it must be really, really complex to look that bad.
Well,
I don't know.
But the thing is, though, Petras has been starting since his sophomore year.
Yeah, this is his third year.
They didn't have any problems putting him in 2 years ago.
Yeah, who's the last quarterback we had who waited beyond his sophomore year? I mean, Stanley started as a sophomore. Bethard
That's right.
Bethard didn't start till his junior.
Stanzi?
But Stanzi, yeah. Vandenberg
so
had to wait.
Third year.
Yeah,
Pete's
so this
is third year.
Third
year starting year, right?
And he's still struggling, yeah. I mean, it's just it just doesn't make sense.
I think Drew Tate, didn't he start as a – well, I guess it was a sophomore.
He started as a sophomore. Yeah.
Did he redshirt?
No, he did not. He did.
Oh, okay.
You know, he did not. He got in too much in 2003, including the bowl game, you know, toward the end. So, but, no, I don't know. I mean, Mike, what would you – I mean, if Kirk Ferentz – or let's go in a different way. If Brian Ferentz calls you up, Mike, what would you tell him?
Well, you know, I do agree with Indy Hawk. I think he made a really good point here about the offensive line. I think there's room for improvement on the offensive line. The problem is I don't see any room for improvement with Petras now in his third year. And one thing that will help the offensive line is a quarterback with some mobility. And another thing that will help the offensive line is to have at least some sort of competence with a vertical passing game. And we have no vertical passing game right now. So they're going to stack the line, which is what they're doing.
Yeah.
We're not going to have success running the ball if you can't get them off the line by throwing some passes downfield. When was the – I don't think we've thrown one, like, long pass in these first two games. I think they tried to do it in that series, if you remember the series after we got the block kick and then scored real quick. Take 7
right.
lead, we got the ball back. And I think where Petras fumbled, if you recall, he was going back to try to throw long, but he got it got a little breakdown of the pressure there, and they got him and before he could get the pass off, and he fumbled. And after that, we were just back to the old ways. But without a vertical passing game, now I think that makes we've got an offensive line in progress here, but there is some talent there, and I think they can get better. But having a quarterback that's not mobile, that misses open throws, and we've had we had like 10 or 12 punts in each of these two games, and we're not playing powerhouses here. Iowa State scored 10 points.
Yeah.
And, they finally got a touchdown there after the Iowa defense got gassed after, the
and frankly, and frankly,
30,
and frankly,
38
I think,
to 22.
Yeah, I think if Justin Jacobs had been playing last Saturday, that might not even have happened either. So, I mean, I think we just would have been a little deeper. And I think that's the one thing that's hurting us, by the way, it also is depth. I mean, yes, you can yell at Charlie Jones all you want, and I will. I mean, if he gets injured in the next couple of games or something happens, I'm not going to care one way or the other. I really don't. I mean, I don't wish him to get injured, but I don't care what happens to him. But I mean, that kind of thing that kills our depth. I mean, Jackson Ritter on the wide receivers being out kills our depth. Losing both Britt and Davenkoff hurts our depth badly on the offensive line. I mean. Yeah. Don't tell me a Justin Britt being back wouldn't have made a difference in the line. I got to believe that would be the case,
What's happened to Brody Brett?
Well, he has been injured, and so he's supposedly going to play. Keegan Johnson's still kind of iffy, but Reganey, there's a shot to play. I mean, I think, nothing against Alec Wick. He's doing what he can, but, I mean, he's still a walk-on freshman, You just can't expect that guy to go out and light it up.
Here's a glimmer of hope, and it's the tiniest of glimmers. I will say, and we got a little help with that sideline foul and the offside that allowed us to get down into field goal position. But the last drive, surprising, because we hadn't done anything. We actually managed to move into field goal position. But there were a couple throws there that were made, the one where they I can't remember the receiver now where they had to review, and he did catch it, definitely. And
Alec,
then the final
Alec
pass.
Wick. Alec Wick.
Yeah, and then the final pass to LaPorta, which was a nice play, and he got out of bounds. They got us down about the 30, but the weather was so bad it was just hard. Field goal kicker, he didn't make it, and maybe Shudak would have, maybe Duncan would have, like Kirk had said earlier, but he just barely missed it, actually. Didn't miss it by much.
Right.
But it was a tough ask, just barely missed. It would have been an unbelievable way to tie that game and send it into overtime if we'd made that field goal. It was amazing to me. But for some reason, all of a sudden, we made a couple plays in the passing, and the only real vertical passing I can think of the whole game, they got us down in there. So, I don't know, maybe there's something there at the end. Maybe Iowa State was in a prevent, but whatever it was, I mean, they made a couple plays to get us down there, and we had a chance to tie it at the end.
You know,
yeah,
I think
we had zero pass attempts over 20 yards. Zero.
Wow.
To that point.
Yeah.
I mean, 150
right,
total yards of offense. 150 total yards of offense. That is just pitiful. That's just pitiful.
It is.
You know. Torrey Taylor, of course, continues to light it up. And for the second week in a row, we have the Big Ten Special Teams Player of the Week, Lucas Van Ness, for blocking two punts. Unfortunately, one of them was wasted. Oh, that's the other thing. You know, Arlen Bruce, that trip, you know, when he tripped up. But the other thing, why aren't we running ghost mode? You know, why, when we're lining up and running those jet sweeps, why are we never faking? Oh, you know, teams do it all the time where you fake it and it works to fake it. You know, it is misdirection, but man, fake it once in a while. Make them have to stay home for it. In this case, we're giving them every reason not to even have to worry about the backside. I mean, it's just, you know, I don't get that. That's one of the things that infuriates me, is that when you see Arlen Bruce going in motion like that, you know what's coming. You know, it's just, it just infuriates me. Okay, so let's get to last week's games. We all were right on Ohio State and Minnesota. We were all wrong on Northwestern. We were all right on Penn State. We were all wrong on Wisconsin. We were all right on Maryland and Michigan State. You guys took Illinois. I took UVA. We all went with Purdue and Rutgers. We all lost, except for Indy. You took Georgia Southern. Wow. Indy took Georgia Southern. So
is that right? I forgot that.
Yeah, Indy took Georgia
Southern.
Yeah, but he also he took Illinois when I took UVA, so man, he might be pulling into the lead. I'll have to figure it out for later on what the totals are. But so this week, our games: UConn at Michigan, UConn at Michigan. Anybody? Let's put it this way: is anybody not taking Michigan?
No, but who's going to start?
McCarthy. Yeah, was his
okay.
Name
they're
going to
stay with him then. Okay.
Yeah,
yeah,
and they were. That's another one that
really
came
good.
Up. Yeah, that's another one that
maybe
came up
McNamara
on the big.
Maybe McNamara will go into the portal and we could get it, you know. But that's another thing too. Why does Iowa under Kirk, they never go into the portal? When did we go into the portal to try to get anybody?
It takes three years
to learn the offense.
We've gone after guys, but we haven't usually gotten any high profile ones. I mean, you know, we did get Van Valkenburgh and Heflin. You know, those were guys that we got out of the portal. Technically speaking, but I don't think anybody else wanted them. So Oklahoma at Nebraska, anybody taking Nebraska? No?
No, but I think Nebraska will play a tougher game than many people think, but Oklahoma's going to win.
Yeah. Boy, if there's a time I'd like to see Oklahoma lose, that would be it. But it's really Lincoln Riley I want to see lose, not the new guy. So Southern Illinois at Northwestern, anybody taking Southern Illinois? Okay.
Now I'm going with Northwestern.
Okay. Now this is a good game. Purdue at Syracuse. Indy, who are you going to pick there?
I'm going to take the under. It's at 58.5. Can I do that?
You can try. You can try, but you still got to pick a winner.
I'll take Purdue.
Okay. So last week, just so Mike knows, because I had to look at this, last week Syracuse, they won the first week. They had a good win the first week against I forgot who. And then last week they beat up UConn 48-14 on the road. Now UConn is no world beater or anything, but I don't think Syracuse is as bad as we're thinking. So, Mike, I'll throw it out to you. Who do you want?
I think Syracuse is a decent team. I still kind of believe that Purdue's a decent team, and so I'm going to give Purdue the edge. But, you know, that should be a good game. You know, Purdue, I that Penn State game was a tough loss. It could have gone either way. So I give Purdue a shot here. I'm going to pick Purdue.
Okay. I'm going with the Q's. I'm going anti-Charlie Jones. I'm just being as irrational as Brother Tommy with his Illinois picks last year. Western Kentucky to Indiana. Anybody want Western Kentucky?
Nope.
No? Okay. No. So we're all going to take Indiana. Okay, Rutgers at Temple. Anybody know how good Temple is?
I don't know too much about Temple, but Rutgers has been a little bit impressive in the first two games, and so I'm going to stay with Rutgers. Go with the Big Ten.
Is John Chaney still the coach here? Oh, no, it's basketball. My bad.
Yeah. So Temple won last week over Lafayette, and then the week before they lost to Duke 30-0. So, yeah, I'd kind of say we'll probably all go Rutgers. This is a good one, although I'm not sure how good the host team is, but Penn State goes down to Auburn. Any thoughts for anyone on that one?
Yeah.
You know
Mike,
what?
I'll start with you.
Go ahead, Mike.
Penn State had a good road win already, and I don't know how tough Auburn is this year. I mean, I'm sure they're decent, but I kind of like the look of Penn State. With if Sean Clifford's healthy, I think they win.
Okay. Indy, how about you?
I'm going Penn State. Clifford was 28 for 32 last year when they beat Auburn. So.
Okay.
Happened to Auburn?
Yeah, they beat Mercer, who is, you know, nothing. San Jose State, they beat by 8 points last week. So, yeah, I'm not sure what the heck has happened to Auburn, but I know that they're not the Auburn that they were. So now you're going to take both of you guys are going to take Penn State then?
Yes, I am.
Yeah.
Yes, I am too.
I think it's real simple. Penn State's a very good team. They may not be the best team or anything like that, even in the East, but I think they are definitely a good team. So. We're going to see what happens to them. So, interesting on that Mercer team, they had originally a kid, Tyler Goodson's younger brother, on that team. I don't see him on their roster now. I don't know what's happened to him or anything. So, maybe he's injured, or maybe he went into the portal and went somewhere else. So, I don't know. I have to see. So, yeah, we'll all go with Penn State. Okay, Colorado at Minnesota. Mike, you know how good Colorado is or is not. What's the story? I'll start with you.
I don't think Colorado's very good. I think Minnesota may be the best team in the Big Ten West right now. After that Wisconsin loss, again, don't want to make too much out of one game, but Minnesota, and I see Minnesota play somebody good, but they're playing a Pac-12 team. I think Minnesota wins.
Okay. And Indy, how about you?
The spread on this game is 27, Minnesota. Which,
really?
What's happened to Colorado? It's like, you know, I tend to see these programs. You're like, okay, that's a good program, but yeah, I'll go Minnesota.
Okay, so yeah, I'm going Minnesota too. I think they're for real. I think they're a legit team. I think they, you know, they've got that running back group that's just for some reason even without Glenn Mason, they're. You know, they seem to get it done. So, yeah, that's
what's happened to Colorado since T-Bode left Colorado. That's the question.
Well,
I got to check in.
Hawkeye Mike's still there.
Yeah, what's
going
on there, Mike?
They haven't been, you know, for a long time, they haven't really had been up to snuff. I used to go to some games back in the 90s when I had my
isn't
plan
that where,
out
isn't
here
that,
in Colorado.
Isn't that where Mel Tucker was before he went to Michigan State?
Yeah, I think so. They had a lot of success, if you recall, in the 90s. Who's that coach they had back then?
Bill McCartney.
Anyway.
Bill McCartney.
Yeah,
yeah, Bill McCartney.
Right.
Cordell Stewart.
Eric Bieniemy. Yeah.
Yeah. Guys, they've lost to TCU 38-13 and Air Force 41-10. So, yeah, that spread is not exactly a shock. New Mexico State at Wisconsin. I assume we're all taking New Mexico State.
No.
I think Wisconsin bounces back here, yeah.
Okay. And Toledo and Ohio State. Indy, we'll start with you. Oh, Toledo and Ohio State. Or am I wasting my time again on this one?
Ohio State edges Toledo.
I think, yeah.
Edges. Okay. This is
what's the spread on that one? 45, 50?
I don't know because I only look on up scores on, or schedules on ESPN. I don't get any betting sites.
I don't know.
I'm at a loss. Here's a good one: Michigan, Washington. Washington has a 45-20 win over Kent State and a 52-6 win over Portland State. Michael Penix, former Indiana Hoosier, has thrown for 345 and 337 yards. So, Indy, we'll start with you. Michigan State, Washington, who are you going with?
Two Big Ten teams. There's the prediction for you. I'm gonna go Michigan State. They haven't allowed a passing touchdown yet. I saw that, and their defense is always good. So if you don't know, go defense.
Okay, Mike, how about you?
Well, I'm going to go the other way. I think it sounds like Washington's clicking on offense. This game's in Seattle. I think Michigan State is going to have a tough time, and I think Washington's going to win it.
I do, too. Partly in honor of the fact that my son-in-law, who went to the University of Montana last year, Montana beat Washington in the first game of the season, but I think this is their – Penix is the difference. That's just me,
yeah.
But I think that's, you know. Okay, this is the next one. Mike, you're up first on this one. Southern Methodist at Maryland.
I'm kind of a Maryland believer. They've shown me that they've got a pretty high-powered offense. I think they're on the way up. I think Maryland wins.
Okay. Indy, how about you?
You got to take the over on this, the highest over I've ever seen. It's 73.5. This game could end 38-35 and go under. So that'll be entertaining just to watch. But I'll go Maryland.
Maryland,
this team
okay.
is like top 10 in yards per play. Should be a great game to watch.
Yeah, I'm going Maryland as well.
If you like
they're the home team. So, okay, Nevada at Iowa. Indy, starting with you.
Hawks are favored by 11 safeties and a field goal. I'm going to take the Hawks to win it. Now, I've been cleaning up on just take the under for the total game and take Petras under on his yards. Just going to throw that out there. It's 4-for-4 so far.
I think any side bets or whatever they call them, those are not good bets. Mike, how about you? Who are you taking?
On this, yeah, well, the interesting stat on this is that Nevada lost last week to the Incarnate Word and gave up 55 points. So if Iowa struggles offensively against Nevada, I don't know where we're at. We've got to win this game. I mean, I can't see how we, even with this offense, they're probably going to go over 300 yards against these guys. And in a way, it'll be a false sense of security because it's just Nevada's got some real defensive problems. You give up 55 points to the Incarnate Word, you know.
Patriots
yeah, they,
are
have
I a
mean,
great game.
That's the Jay Norvell loss, you know, influence that they have. So we're going to go for the tiebreaker on this. We're going to go. Does Iowa's total yards? We'll just say an over under. Iowa total yards 350 over on or no? Just go to total yards. Indy, what are Iowa's total yards going to be?
I'm going to say 410. I think the offensive line starts to put it together. Get a couple guys back on offense, hopefully, although they'll probably rest them. But I think this is just a mismatch physically up front, both sides of the ball.
Okay, Mike, Iowa total yards.
Yeah, I agree. They'll go over 350. If we can't get over 350 against these guys, then, like I said.
So how many are you going?
I don't know what we'll do.
Well, give me a number.
I think we'll crack 400 yards. We'll be optimistic.
So you want to say more or less than 410?
How about just a little less than 410? I'll go with just 400. 390.
Okay, well, I got to pick one.
We should get 500 or 600 yards if we had any offense. It's not going to happen. I think we might get to 4.
Okay, I'm going to go with 368 yards. I'm that confident in my call. I just think I don't think we get 400 yards. I think I think we need a busted play, and we probably get. You know what? If we get 400 yards, I'll bet 250 of it or more is on the ground. I just don't. You know, I don't know what it is about our passing game, but I just don't see it right now. So okay, guys, I got to close off. Indy, I hope you had fun sitting in the chat room with some weirdos that came in there for a while.
That was interesting.
It was some weird stuff. It was some bizarre stuff, I got to tell you. Thanks, guys. Yeah, thanks, guys, for being on. I want to thank Sue from New Mexico for calling in, my big sister, and, of course, Kirk for calling in earlier. And I'm going to let you guys go. In the meantime, I have got to give a final little thing on Scott Frost that I promised myself I would do. So I'll talk to you guys next week. Thanks, guys. Okay, Scott Frost. You know, Mike said if he loses one of those games, he'll get fired. He was right. I thought he would not make it through the season anyway. Look, I think Scott Frost is a clown. I think he painted himself into a corner with statements he made after his hiring. I can't say I think of him as a stand-up guy in light of his involvement and or support of disgusting misdeeds by both teammates while he was at school and players while he was head coach. Still, I feel for the guy, and nobody can believe that he expected this to play out the way it did. But another guy who I think is sort of a clown as a coach, Dave Wannstedt, made some good points and gave some good advice. He said this. He said, "Scott, leave town now. Staying just muddles the situation. Get past this, clear your head, and move on. It's frustrating, maybe even heartbreaking, but the best thing to do is move on, and that starts with leaving Lincoln now." Look, Wannstedt's been there. He knows what takes place in the aftermath. The sudden everything is better now sentiments and maybe even some inspirational wins. That's tough to watch. Number two, Scott Frost is a Nebraska alum. He won a national championship as a quarterback on Tom Osborne's last team. He was the golden boy with big expectations, both for and from himself and the fan base. Look, he had success at UCF, but that's not the Big Ten. And yet it's doubly painful not succeeding and having it be at your alma mater. It really isn't fair for him to stay. It's not fair to Mickey Joseph. It's not fair to his players. Most of all, it's not fair to himself. Staying only prolongs and deepens the agony. It raises the specter of more regrets, enough of which I am sure he already has. Like I said, I don't wish ill will on the guy. And the thought of a more competent head coach leading Nebraska into Iowa City scares me. But in the meantime, good luck to Scott Frost and good luck to Mickey Joseph. Thanks again for being here, folks, even you weirdos in the chat room. In the meantime, folks, have a great weekend. Have a great rest of the week. And we will see you next time. Have a good weekend, folks. And good night.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.